Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, November 16, 2016. A senior government official was gunned down in Wau by unidentified men.
So the incident took place while the Night Petroleum was in other side. But immediately after the accident, the Night Petroleum rushed into the place in order to rescue the situation, but it was too late.
And Kenya decides to hold up on its promise to close down the Dadaab refugee camp.
The request for the extension is due to a very delicate situation in Somalia. The Somali government is undergoing election period, and there are quite a number of areas which has not been secured.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A Lowell State senior official was gunned down in Wau town last night. Pasquale Francis Farmer, the political affairs advisor to Lowell State Governor Rizik Zakaria Hassan, was killed at his residence in Awil Jadid area in Wau. An eyewitness say three unidentified gunmen stormed Farmer's home about 10:30 last night. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
A personal guard for the late Pasquale Francis Farmer, who prefers not to be identified by name for fear of revenge, says he tried to shoot the three men, but his AK-47 failed to fire. Speaking in Arabic, the guard says he tried his best to prevent attack on Farmer.
I was in my room in the corner, and when I asked them, "Who are you?" they opened fire on me. But when I took up my gun and wanted to respond, my gun did not work. I tried that almost twice, but it could not work. After a while, I heard the big man calling me and asking what was going on. I told him that three thieves came and I wanted to shoot them, but the gun did not function. So he came and took the gun from me and went to the neighbor next door.
The guard says his boss exchanged fire with the three men for nearly 3 minutes before they shot him at the back. The guard says he could not help his boss fight the attackers because he did not have a gun.
I could hear his voice talking to his neighbor, telling him that we have some suspicious people around. And as he was talking to his neighbor, they began to shoot, and he began exchanging fire with them. He was shot at his back, and he fell down just here.
Mel Aleu is the Wau town mayor. He says security personnel have arrested one suspect in connection with the incident. Aleu says Wau town is secure because of a joint night patrol between police and the army.
So the incident took place while the Night Petroleum was in other side. But immediately after the accident, the Night Petroleum rushed into the place in order to rescue the situation, but it was too late.
Governor Zakaria describes late Farmer as a loyal person committed to serving his community in Lowell State.
So we are assigning him about to follow up about with the asset distribution with Lowell State. There were so many issues connecting us with Lowell State. We had assigned him to follow up these things. So I never raised any suspicions or doubts of life threat to himself. We are patient. We are following up with Lowell State so that they should inform us about their fact finding and what are the reasons and who are the assassins.
Late Farmer was elected a member of parliament in the former Western Barghazali State Assembly in 2010. Farmer was appointed a political advisor to Governor Zakaria following President Kiir's decision to split the country into 28 states. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
There are only two pharmaceutical manufacturers who produce pneumonia vaccine, and one of them recently announced plans to lower the price of one of its life-saving drugs for civil society organizations serving children in emergencies. Ian Bior has more from Washington.
Pneumonia is the leading cause of child mortality worldwide, killing more than 1 million children every year. The deadly infection was responsible for killing over 22,000 children last year in South Sudan alone. In an effort to reduce the disease burden, American pharmaceutical company Pfizer has announced it will lower the price of its pneumonia vaccine by a significant amount for civil society organizations serving children in emergencies. Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, calls the price reduction a significant step in protecting vulnerable children. Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline, or GSK, a British pharmaceutical company, are the only two manufacturers who produced the pneumonia vaccine. GSK announced in September that it would reduce the price of its vaccine for humanitarian situations. Pfizer followed with its announcement on Friday. Pneumonia is a preventable disease, but at the same time is the leading infectious cause of death among children under 5 worldwide. It kills about 2,500 children a day, according to the UN's Children's Agency. Pfizer's website says children 6 weeks to 5 years old require a series of 4 doses of the vaccine. Children 6 through 17 years old, as well as adults, require a single dose of the vaccine, called Prevnar 13. MSF says the high price of pneumococcal conjugate vaccines, or PCV, has prevented about 1/3 of the world's countries from introducing the vaccine to its population, and children in crisis-affected countries are especially susceptible to pneumonia. Pfizer's price reduction is only for civil society organizations, but MSF hopes that the price cut will be extended to all developing countries so that more people will have access to it. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Even though malaria-carrying mosquitoes are becoming more resistant to insecticides, chemically treated bed nets still offer significant protection against the disease. That's the finding of a 5-year study released today at the annual meeting of American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene in Atlanta. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization, with funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, conducted the study in Benin, Cameroon, Kenya, Sudan, and India. It looked at the effectiveness of what are called long-lasting insecticidal nets. WHO scientist Dr. Tessa Knox helped evaluate them.
The main outcome from the study was very positive. It basically indicated that the long-lasting nets that are being used all throughout sub-Saharan Africa are actually still working. That was a very critical finding to show that we really do need to proceed with this scale-up of nets and make sure that everybody who's living in at-risk areas is sleeping under a net and using the net correctly.
But if mosquitoes have a resistance to the chemicals in bed nets, how do they provide significant protection against malaria?
So a mosquito could land on a net, and while it wouldn't die immediately, what it would do is continue to search on the net for a hole so that it can penetrate and go underneath and bite the person beneath the net. In the process of searching on the net, it contacts the net surface and absorbs insecticide. And as it absorbs that insecticide, it would eventually take on a lethal dose, which would kill that mosquito. So even if they don't die immediately, the searching process would mean that eventually they may die.
Nevertheless, Knox says there's still an urgent need for new and improved malaria-fighting tools.
Some of these tools that have recently been evaluated are things like new insecticides or new formulations that combine more than one insecticide. Also looking at genetic manipulation of the mosquitoes that can be released, which would basically change the structure of a mosquito population in an area and reduce its ability to transmit malaria. But at the moment, and in the near future, we anticipate insecticidal nets will continue to be the mainstay of malaria prevention.
At a study site in Sudan, researchers sprayed the walls of homes with an insecticide that differed from chemicals used in bed nets. They say that reduced infections by an additional 50% compared with using long-lasting insecticidal nets alone. Dr. Knox says insecticides used against malaria should not cause any ill effects in people.
All of the chemicals that are being applied broadly across sub-Saharan Africa have been through a very strict safety testing to get the WHO recommendation that would allow their usage. So there aren't any concerns with the current insecticides that have been using in the nets, nor are there concerns with the sprays that are being used on the wall, if they're being used in the correct way.
The World Health Organization calls long-lasting insecticidal nets the cornerstone of malaria control efforts in sub-Saharan Africa, which shoulders 90% of the global malaria burden. It says availability of the nets in this region rose from 2% in the year 2000 to 53% in 2015. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Kenyan government is delaying its decision to close the huge Dadaab refugee camp, which houses nearly 300,000 people, most of them Somalis. But Kenya's interior minister insists the process to repatriate the Somalis will continue. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan Interior Minister Joseph Nkaiseri said his country had postponed the closure of the Dadaab camp, currently home to more than 280,000 Somali refugees. Nkaiseri told reporters in Nairobi Wednesday the Kenyan government was responding to a request by the United Nations Refugee Agency UNHCR and Somali government not to close the camp.
I wish to announce that the government has accepted the request to extend the deadline for the completion of repatriation of Somali refugees and eventual closure of the Dadaab refugee complex by 6 months. However, the ongoing voluntary repatriation will continue uninterrupted.
The minister was joined by UNHCR officials and Somali government representatives. In May, Kenya's government announced it will shut down the Dadaab by November 30th. The camp was opened in 1991, when Somalia descended into civil war after the fall of the Mohamed Siad Barre regime. At one point, the sprawling camp held some 400,000 refugees. Kenyan security agencies repeatedly said the camp was a security threat, citing activity in the camp by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. In recent months, tens of thousands of Somali refugees have returned home. However, most of the returnees say basic needs, such as food, shelter, clean water and schools, are not being met. Nkaiseri says the political and security situation in Somalia has led Kenya to reconsider their earlier decision.
The request for the extension was due to a very delicate situation in Somalia. The Somali government is undergoing election period, and there are quite a number of areas which has not been secured.
Al-Shabaab still controls many parts of South and Central Somalia and continues to fight forces of the government and the African Union force AMISOM, of which Kenya is a part. Somali ambassador to Kenya Jamal Mohamed Hassan says his country lacks the capacity to take back its citizens.
On the Somali side, I would like to tell the world that we are willing and ready to receive our people. All we are trying to do now is to make sure that the absorption capacity on the other side is increased and we prepare the grounds for them to come back.
When the new deadline to close the Dadaab comes in May of next year, Nkaiseri says Somalis who have not returned home will be sent to other refugee camps.
The closure of the Dadaab complex does not mean Kenya is not taking refugees anymore. We still have Kakuma. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees has other refugee camps spread all over the world. That is a program which will be considered.
Amnesty International released a statement that it welcomes the announcement to suspend the closure of the camp, but calls on the Kenyan government to end what it called the forceful repatriation. In the coming weeks, Kenya will host a special summit of the regional bloc IGAD to discuss the Somali refugee crisis and regional security. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at U.S. President-elect Donald Trump and Mid East. Stay tuned.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you a good friend? I'm kind. I think I'm a down-to-earth person. I treat people the way they are. As in, I take you, the way you've come to me is the way I handle you.
That you're honest in all times to the other person you call your friend makes you a good friend to me.
What makes me a good friend is the ability to keep what my friends tells me, some of the confidential things they share with me.
I'm a man who makes a lot of jokes. I simplify everything. I give myself to people in the first place so that they can also allow me to be their friend. I'm always accessible.
I laugh a lot. And laughing a lot is one of the most things that people really like about me being as their friend.
I would say what makes me a good friend is the way I support and protect my friends.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. As Russian and Syrian government forces resume air attacks on Aleppo, there are growing fears among Syrian rebels. They may lose U.S. support once President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Henry Ridgewell reports that across the Middle East, rival powers are trying to digest the implication of Trump's election victory.
Russian jets take off from the aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov to launch airstrikes on rebel-held Aleppo, Syria. Moscow said it was the first time in Russian naval history that its single aircraft carrier has been involved in combat actions. The United States accuses Russia and its Syrian government allies of causing mass civilian deaths. But President-elect Donald Trump signalled a softened tone during his election campaign, and that could herald a change of policy, says Jane Kinnenmont of London Policy Institute, Chatham House.
Trump has been relatively positive about Russia under Vladimir Putin and Russia's role in Syria as a supposed force against ISIS.
That has raised fears the Trump administration may withdraw support for Sunni rebel fighters, handing a big advantage to the Syrian government and its Shiite backers in Iran. Conversely, Trump's pledge to tear up the nuclear deal struck between Iran and the West, which saw sanctions dropped in return for limits on nuclear activity, has gained him some support among Sunni regional powers. Trump has described the agreement as disastrous and the worst deal ever negotiated.
Obama has been really disliked by Gulf elites, most of all because of the deal with Iran. They regard him as having been soft and naive on Iran. And the more hawkish language that Donald Trump has used has gone down well, but there is complete uncertainty about what it means in practice.
Wednesday, French President François Hollande warned Trump against reneging on the nuclear deal with Iran.
Mais je sais que là, il y a un principe de réalité.
He said the deal gives guarantees and that the absence of an agreement would be very serious. There are, as yet, few guarantees over the direction of Trump's future foreign policy. Researcher Jane Kinnemont of Chatham House predicts his approach will mark a sharp contrast to that of Barack Obama.
Trump has for years given the impression that he respects the strongman model of government, whether that's in China or in Russia, and that he has seen dictators in the Middle East as at least a force against terrorism.
With conflicts raging from Yemen to Libya, analysts say the Middle East will likely provide the first test for Trump's promised strategic reset of US foreign policy. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Turning now to Nigeria, where the president's anti-corruption campaign continues with high-profile officials facing charges. But activists worry the campaign is becoming increasingly one-sided, accusing the president of targeting his political enemies. Shika Odua reports from Abuja, where the former national security advisor appears in court Wednesday on money laundering charges.
These are the voices of families in tears
as they celebrate the return of 21 Chibok girls.
When she saw me, she couldn't say anything. She was just crying, you know. And she was saying it was just like a dream, as if it's something they've given up on. They never thought they would make it through, but lo and behold, they are out, and it's that smell of freedom or something else.
Dr. Alan Manasseh described the moment one of his cousins saw him on Sunday at the official reunion ceremony with other Chibok families in Abuja. He reunited with two of his cousins who were kidnapped by Boko Haram in April 2014 from their secondary school in Chibok. One is named Gloria Dame, who was 18 years old when she was kidnapped. The other one is Mariamu Lawan. When he saw them, he became overwhelmed. He also notes they look like they had suffered.
I say it's difficult to describe the feeling, you know. They look leaner than when they were abducted.
None of his cousins came back with any children, Manasseh says. He also said they told him they were not forced to marry any Boko Haram members. But their lean bodies are proof that they experienced hunger while they were held captive by Boko Haram. One of the cousins, Gloria, said some of the girls had no food to eat for 40 days. The Nigerian government says talks are continuing to bring back another 83 of the nearly 200 girls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Whether or not a ransom was paid for the 21 released last week remains unclear. The Nigerian government denied a report from the Associated Press that millions of dollars were paid by the Swiss government on behalf of Nigeria. The Nigerian government also says no imprisoned Boko Haram members were exchanged for the girls. But Iman Shehu, one of the leaders of the Bring Back Our Girls movement that has advocated for the kidnapped girls' release, doubts the government's story.
We think that something happened, that even when government say officially nothing happened, it turns out that something did happen. That has always been the history of negotiating for hostages in the hands of terrorists.
Shehu says the group will watch for the rest of the month to see if other girls are rescued. If not, it will continue to put pressure on the Nigerian government. For now, Chibok families will hold on to the memory of what it felt like to hold their daughters for the first time in 2 years. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
Now we go to Cameroon for some soccer news. Africa's biggest women's soccer tournament, the African Women's Cup of Nations, is due to kick off on Saturday in Cameroon. But fans may have trouble getting to the matches if bus drivers continue a strike that has seen them park their buses across major roads in the capital, bringing traffic to a complete halt. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé. The drivers are pledging to disrupt the event if they are not paid back salary.
Thousands of cars were stuck early Wednesday on the streets of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. One of the drivers was Atangana Anslem, a father of five, attempting to drop off his kids at school. The civil servant says the traffic congestion is unprecedented. He says he has been on this spot with his family for over 1 hour 45 minutes and there are no signs traffic will start moving soon. He says such acts affects Cameroon's economy and gives the country a bad image and reputation. He says he does not think his children will be able to go to school soon, as the situation is disturbing. Businessman Fuda Anatole parked his car on the side of the road and decided to walk. He says he wants the government to know that he took 1 hour 30 minutes to cover a distance of barely half a kilometer and that he, like other poor people, is suffering. The congestion was caused by workers of the urban transport company Lebus. They parked their buses on major junctions and went hiding for a greater portion of the morning. The trade union leader, Amugu Ondua, says they are owed 20 months of salaries and other social benefits. He says they will not transport people during the Africa Women's Football Cup of Nations that begins on Saturday and will stop others from working if their money is not paid.
Le PM a écrit une lettre, il a donné des instructions au ministère des Finances.
He says after a crisis meeting on Tuesday, they were informed that Cameroon's Prime Minister had ordered the Minister of Finance to pay their salary arrears for 20 months and other social dues, but that a representative of the Minister of Finance said he could not pay the money because their company owed taxes and custom duties. He says they will interrupt the Africa Women's Cup of Nations tournament in Yaoundé if all of their dues are not paid. 45 of the 125 bus drivers were arrested. Public authorities in Yaoundé refused to comment, but state media said they were convening a crisis meeting. In May, workers abandoned work after a tunnel at the main stadium for the tournament collapsed, leaving two people dead and several others injured. The incident occurred after Cameroon's Prime Minister forced builders to speed up construction work amid concerns that Cameroon might not be ready for the COP. Despite the challenges, the president of the Confederation of African Football, Issa Ayatou, says Cameroon is set for the games.
Ça ne peut qu'être un bon événement, c'est-à-dire les infrastructures sportives.
He says it is going to be a beautiful event, judging from the sports infrastructure and the many people watching the matches, and that all will be crowned with the high level of participating teams. He says the government of Cameroon has done everything it takes to develop infrastructure and make the country ready for the continental event. Originally scheduled from October 8 to 22, Cameroon asked for the tournament to be postponed to November 19 to December 3 due to weather conditions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that report by Kinzeka brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Waka Waka by Shakira and Freshly Grounds of South Africa.
You're a good soldier, choosing your battle. Pick yourself up and dust yourself off and back in the saddle. You're on the front line, everyone's watching. You know it's serious, we're getting closer, this isn't over. The pressure's on, you feel it. But you got it all, believe it. When you fall, get up, oh, oh. And if you fall, get up, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sangalewa. Cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. It's time for Africa. Listen to your dad, this is our motto. Your time to shine, don't wait in line. Vamos por todo. People are raising their expectations. Go on and feed them, this is your moment. Hesitation. Today's your day. I feel it. You pave the way. Believe it. If you get down, get up. Oh, oh. When you get down, get up. Hey, hey. Tamina, mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa. Tamina, mina, hey, hey. Waka, waka, hey, hey. Tamina, mina, sangalewa. Anawa, ah, ah. Tamina, mina, hey, hey. Waka, waka, hey, hey. Tamina, mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa.
We have been listening to Shakira and Freshly Ground of South Africa with the song Waka Waka. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.